Thank you so much for coming. It's exam time, it's May, it's quite a nice evening. There's a whole world outside of the LSE, but you have chosen, and rightly so, to spend the next hour in the company of some very, very interesting people. And one more who is about to arrive, a surprise guest that is not even listed on the screen of honour that you see before you. Anyway, the ethics of fashion. Now, before I introduce the panel, and they're not sitting in the order of the names, but you can try if you get bored of me talking, find out who's who according to the panel behind. I'm just going to say why we're actually doing it. Now, there is actually the presence of television camera from Singapore. There is also the BBC World Radio service here. Irish Radio rang me up 2 days beforehand because they didn't want to miss it and interviewed me over the phone. There's also, I think, ID Magazine is here, and hopefully Vogue, ready for the website, is also going to be monitoring events tonight. A very, very big welcome, by the way, to students of the Institut Français de la Mode, who are the cheering faction in the front and middle rows, and it's great that you're here at the London School of Economics. Now, it was very, very interesting about why we decided to host what will be the first of definitely two, and who knows, three, symposia, table ronde, and I hope you note that the new round is now oblong, as in black and orange and whatever, but we are not having a sort of table ronde, but a panel discussion. We actually thought, why shouldn't we have here at the London School of Economics a discussion about fashion? When I talked to various academics about why we're doing it, some people immediately said, and immediately got what we were doing, saying, well, we should be doing this. I mean, it's such an essential part of people's lives. The immense spread of the global fashion industry, the fact that we all banally wear clothes, the fact that we all interact either knowingly or unknowingly with fashion, either as a perceived concrete concept or as something you put on in the morning. All of those people said we should be doing it. Some people said, but why? It's got nothing to do with the LSE. So LSE has nothing to do with sociology, anthropology, marketing, management, economics, the list goes on. And if the beaver is the symbol of the LSE, trying to find out the causes of all things, and the Latin just escapes at the moment, this is one beaver we're not going to wear, because this is about the ethics of fashion, how we should be operating, what we should be doing, how producers should be thinking of producing clothes, how people working in the industry should be paying the employees. It's a global affair. And what was fascinating, if you got the Independent today, are 2 pages about a new report published by Gap highlighting the malpractice that still exists in hundreds, if not thousands, of factories across the world. So yes, it is a very hot issue, and hot issues do concern the London School of Economics, and we're concerned about it here. The idea of wages, fair play, is one aspect of it, and this is the aspect we'll be looking at by 2 of the speakers tonight at this particular event. But ethical questions are not just about fair wages. It's also, why is fashion so important, either indirectly or directly, to so many people today? And why is it that some of us in this room spend probably far too much money on things? What attracts us? Why do we still want to define ourselves by things that cost the earth, even if we buy them in the sales like I do, 70% off, I'm a sales vulture right at the end of those Harvey Nichol days of summer, and they're just around the corner. Why do we do it? You are yourselves, and yet we quite like importing identity, wearing other people's brands. But that's just a normal thing. We do try and define ourselves by many things, by what we do, by what we say, but also by what we wear. We want to appear to be part of sometimes very subtle complex groups in the world. And the number of groups, the layers of groups, is more and more as we're all becoming more and more media savvy. It's ephemeral, but it's long-lasting. I grew up in Manchester. For some of you, it means nothing. For me, it meant Kendall Milnes, the Harrods of the North. I was very lucky that I graduated from reading my mother's Vogue magazines to becoming, at the time of the early 60s, a very famous child model. In fact, I still have the copies of Yorkshire, Lancashire and Cheshire Life that feature me on the cover in a pair of ski pants, V-neck sweater and bobble hat outside Lyme Hall. I was, in those days, exclusive to Jaeger, and really it was like being the Naomi Campbell of the early 60s. However, it didn't last when puberty set in and it all went horribly wrong, and those days are far behind. But although I did modern languages at Oxford, I actually thought I still wanted to do fashion, and I nearly accepted a management trainee course at Jaeger that would have been the full cycle, child model at Jaeger, management training at Jaeger. And I thought, no, because the guilt clicked in. I've got to do something worthwhile. And whether it's a happy ending or not, I became a school teacher for 14 years of my life. Anyway, I've divided up this talk into the fighters, the doers, and the thinkers. The fighters, well, the mystery guest who I don't think has appeared yet but is on her way. The fighter is obviously Sumi Dhanarajan from Oxford, who, I don't mind if you be talking first, sorry about that, who is going to really be outlining the amazing work that Oxfam has done in really looking at the way people operate and the way companies operate as well. The doers, Pablo Flack, not only House of Jazz, not only one of the award winners from London Fashion Week, but also an alumnus of the London School of Economics in Economic History. Ooh, yes. Cheers, I think, a little bit from the home crowd there. Also, Charlie Porter, one of the best fashion journalists. In fact, I think that's a misnomer. He's a great journalist who happened to work in fashion for The Guardian and whose columns I read with great, great pleasure, has now gone over, crossed over, gone up, but is associate editor to GQ magazine. They are the doers, and they'll be looking at perhaps a different aspect of what they mean by ethics. And then we have the thinkers. Elizabeth Rouse from the London College of Fashion and Pascal Morand from EFM Paris, who are going to be looking at the way, from an anthropological point of view, sociological point of view, economic point of view, we actually consider how we mean by fashion. Now, people can talk from there. It's meant to be a round table, as you say, that oblong is the new round. So we're probably not going to be moving from here. But the floor is very much yours now. And we might sort of alter the order of the speakers, but it's very much there. We're going to keep questions to the end. If you've got anything burning, though, and you want to create a sort of fashion moment for yourself, then, of course, put your hands up, stamp, and, you know, do something important. Otherwise, there's plenty of time for questions at the end. Thank you very much. So, Sumi, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it's live.
Okay. How do you compete with something like that next?
Easy.
Firstly, I'd like to think that Oxfam and myself are fighters, doers, and thinkers. But anyway, I shall represent the fighting corner today. My two-year-old has started to go through nursery rhymes, and we've done Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, and Baa Baa, Black Sheep, and she's happened now across Seesaw, Marjorie Daw. And I cringe every time she says this rhyme. And for those of you who have either forgotten Seesaw Marjorie Daw or don't know it, I'll take you through the words. I'm not going to sing because I'm a terrible, terrible singer, as my husband will tell you. It goes, Seesaw Marjorie Daw, Johnny shall have a new master. He shall work, but he shall earn but a penny a day because he can't work any faster. Now, the first two lines of that nursery rhyme are supposed to be just, you know, childish nursery rhymes. But the last three really come from an origin, from a historical origin, and they refer to children in the UK who used to work in workhouses. These are children that were orphans, and it was child labour. They were paid on piece rate, a penny, and Johnny has to work far, can't earn more than that because he can't go fast enough to meet his targets for that day. Workhouses, thankfully, are a thing of the past, but the working conditions that are described in that nursery rhyme are very much prevalent today, and especially so within the fashion industry. Oxfam has been working on this issue for a long time, but over the course of the last 2 years, we've been doing very intensive research, both on working conditions in the fresh produce sector as well as in the garment sector. And what we found is that workers producing clothing and footwear for global high street brands are, like Johnny, working excessively long working hours for pittance as they struggle to meet their daily targets to earn their living. Exhausted, burnt out, no time for childcare, these workers are really working for a short period of their life and then that's the end of it. They have no time to even unionize or organize themselves in order to defend their labor rights. The cause, well, at one level, you can place the blame squarely on their employers. Employers that are unscrupulous, who have no sense of how to manage a workforce, who cannot manage their production planning well enough in order to meet orders from global brands. You can also blame governments who have not adequately enforced labor legislation or protected their citizens. But critically, at another level, these abusive conditions are being perpetuated by the fashion industry. As companies compete to bring out more and more lines at more frequent periods per season, whilst keeping their costs low in order to maintain a healthy profit, so do they place unreasonable demands on their suppliers to meet ever faster turnaround times at low cost price and to be flexible in meeting orders that come in as and when they need it. Suppliers, in turn, respond with a very short-term mentality. They simply shift the risks and the burdens down to the workforce by making their workers work longer, faster, cheaper. Union rights are taken away because you want a workforce that's not going to complain about these conditions. Ethics apply at two levels from what I'm talking about. Firstly, how can a company continue to do business in this way when it sees that its business is causing misery and abuse of human rights? Secondly, as you will know, a number of companies, global brands today, have adopted codes of conduct, ethical policies, and they're making much of this, of these policies in public statements. And yet, how they actually do business, the way in which they put pressure on suppliers, which translates down the line, opens them to accusations of hypocrisy. Oxfam's been campaigning on this issue, and particularly so over the course of the last 3 years. I'm wearing a Make Trade Fair t-shirt. We're campaigning on trade issues broadly and trying to ensure that trade actually does deliver the potential benefits that it has to the poor. With regards to the topic that I talk about, a lot of people will come back and say, well, these workers, particularly women, are having jobs. Aren't jobs with bad wages better than no jobs at all? What we're saying is that that's fine. Yes, these women are in jobs, and that is a good thing. However, the question that we ask is, why are these workers not getting their fair share of the gains of global trade? There are some good things that are coming out of campaigning. Nick mentioned earlier on that there's a two-page spread in The Independent on Gap's social responsibility report. I've just come straight from a meeting with Gap, actually, and it's good news. This is their report. Gap has had in place over a number of years, actually, a code of conduct on compliance. And what it's done with this report is actually to say, look, we've got this policy in place. We're not in a position to put hand on heart and say that our supply chain is completely clean. We've got a policy in place that ensures that we've got a system to check that at least our suppliers are working with us to respect labor standards. We really welcome what Gap's doing. Our challenge to Gap is to say, what you've done so far is to give to your suppliers a code of conduct and to say to your suppliers, comply with this, otherwise we're going to take our business elsewhere. What we're saying to Gap is, let's look one step back and question the way you are dealing with your suppliers and look at how you can deal with your suppliers in a way that's not putting your supplies in this position where they have, on the one hand, got to meet these orders for fast turnaround, fast lead times, lower prices, and on the other hand, are having to comply with your code of conduct, which demands 48-hour working weeks, that demands that workers are paid a living wage. The two just don't meet at the moment. I started off by talking to you about the fictitious Johnny. I want to end with a quote from a very real worker, a young woman from a factory in China that produces goods for well-known sports brands including Nike, Fila, Arena, Adidas, and Reebok. This is what she told our researchers. This research was done for a report that we did called Playfair and the Olympics, which is now backing up a big campaign on the Olympics. She says, We have overtime work until 11 p.m. or midnight every day. The price they pay us per piece is so low that there's no point us working such long hours. If our income was higher, I would have no complaints. But all I have now is exhaustion and a low income. Some of us don't even have enough money to spend on food. It's more than we can bear. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that introduction, because it sets, in many ways, a very firm tone to how we want to proceed this evening in this first section. I think that, I don't know if the panel want to say anything on anything that she said or any initial feelings. Yeah, do it later.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So, Tamsin, you're here.
Great.
The mystery person. Right, Tamsin Lejeune rang me up yesterday, or was it the day before? Yesterday, yes. Saying, I believe you're doing a talk on the ethics of fashion. Yeah, she said, well, I've just started the Ethical Fashion Forum, and I'd really like to come. And again, you know, the timing is everything. Timing with the Independent today, and then with your phone call. And I think it's really great that you're here. So, Tamsin, if you'd like to say a few words about what you're doing, how you are, it'd be great. So, come and join us here. You can either sit down or you can stand, whichever you prefer.
So, I'm Tamsin Lejeune, as Nick. I recently set up something called the Ethical Fashion Forum. The aim of this network is that it's designed as a way of bringing together existing organizations, producer groups, and fashion labels, and fashion businesses, which are already working towards producing clothes in an ethical way. There's a considerable amount of expertise held by a number of organizations and groups, which could be pooled to really produce a database and facilitate sourcing, ethical sourcing. At the moment, there are considerable barriers. I don't know what the makeup of this audience is, but I assume we have some fashion designers here. For fashion designers and small fashion businesses, it's very difficult, especially when you're setting up, and also when you're a large organization, which you'll find from looking at most large organizations, it's very difficult to even consider sourcing ethically. There are barriers in that the information is not available, the networks are not built up to allow for large-scale mainstream production using fair trade groups. Ethical systems are beginning to be put in place in terms of certification of factories, but there really needs to be a lot more dissemination of this information. So the Ethical Fashion Forum is really designed as a way of facilitating that using existing resources. It's already involved and gained the support of quite a number of organizations, including Tradecraft, Label Behind the Label, and a number of very inspiring small labels which are starting to produce cutting-edge fashion design using ethical principles, be that organic sourcing, using organic cotton, or using materials or products produced using fair trade groups, or looking at recycling as part of fashion design. So the key aims of the organization are firstly to break down the barriers to ethical sourcing, secondly to spread awareness of the current structure of the global garment industry, which you've heard a little about. There are widespread problems across the board. And thirdly, to promote and raise the profile of ethical clothing. At the moment, it's not got a very good image, let's face it. Very few of the people here, I imagine, have ever worn fair trade or ethical clothing. And there's no reason why it needs to be categorised as something which is outdated or unfashionable. And I think this is an opportunity to provide publicity and events to really promote this concept and raise awareness of the issue. I'd just like to mention a few things about the current garment industry, which I believe weren't mentioned by a friend, which set the scene for the Ethical Fashion Forum. Labour Behind the Label estimates that approximately 80% of clothing which is produced for the USA market is produced under conditions which are contrary to local law and international local labour standards. I'm afraid I don't have figures for Britain, but you can be almost certain that they're pretty high. On top of that, in Bangladesh, for example, women are working 15-hour days for less than a dollar. And our high street clothing is going down in price. Over the last 10 years, the price of clothing has gone up by less than 1%. And if you look at that in terms of inflation, it's in effect, the price has gone down dramatically. So we're looking at a reduction in the price of clothing, and the people who are losing out from that reduction are people who are in the developing world producing our clothes. In terms of the Ethical Fashion Forum aims to look at production of clothes, both in terms of working conditions, but also the environment. I mean, the environmental impact of the garment industry is enormous. We have 11% of global pesticides being used to grow cotton. Blood poisoning is widespread in cotton pickers. And 30% of German children are thought to suffer from allergies as a result of textiles. So it really is the tip of the iceberg. Now, just to illustrate my point, I'd like to ask the audience a question. Which of you, could you raise your hand, would actually feel slightly more comfortable wearing clothing which was made under conditions which did not exploit people? Okay, just to turn that on its head, how many people here have worn clothing which is produced using fair trade sources or under ethical conditions? A few, that's good. Okay, one other question, just to turn this on its head. How many here would wear clothes which they don't consider cool or stylish or feel comfortable in just because they're ethical? So it's really important that clothing is stylish and ethical at the same time, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be. We have labels such as Kiyuchi Jeans, a really cool jeans brand. Peepletree is bringing out some really interesting stuff. Sari, Juste, the list goes on. And I'd like to leave it there, but if you'd like to learn more, I've left some leaflets out here, and I'll put a list so you can put your name down and be included on a mailing list to hear more information.
Well, thank you, Tamsin, very much. It's great because Tamsin now is part of the panel. It's a great start. We'll make sure the leaflets. Is it going to be a website coming up soon?
Yeah, website www.ethicalfashionforum.com.
Okay, www.ethicalfashionforum.com.
Yeah. In a month.
Fantastic.
The email is the same address.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very, very much. Okay, so we're going to move along down the line. Charlie, would you mind picking up the side of the fashion journalist then?
I fear that I'm going to be the face of the dark side, because obviously fashion journalism is not the most ethical of jobs. In that same issue, The Independent, I don't know if you've read it today, there was a fashion piece about should you call your clothes vintage or secondhand. Apparently fashion people are very upset that vintage is now a high street term for clothes that are look old but aren't actually old. So everyone is now saying secondhand, and they were saying you should go to a charity shop to buy the clothes. Through the piece, they said things about like clothes smelling of like dead bodies, and you know the usual charity shop jokes. And there was a picture of an Oxfam store illustrating it. Not once in the piece was there any mention of the good that buying a clothes in charity shop could do. There was no mention of the money you're giving to the charity. There's no mention of the fact that by buying secondhand, you're also therefore stopping one more purchase in a new kind of possible high street store that is has dubious ethical issues. And it was really interesting that this fashion this particular journalist didn't see that it was interesting to include it in the article. It was never going to be a point of her article. And you'll find that is pretty much the case in just about every single article written in Britain on fashion. Should fashion journalists actually be covering ethics? I mean, it seems fairly obvious to me that they should. I used to work on The Guardian until recently, and every other part of that paper, ethical issues are investigated. There's deep investigation into news, in sports, in the arts. So therefore, it makes sense they should be in fashion too. But why don't fashion journalists cover ethics? The absolutely blunt answer is that most of us are not trained reporters. We're kind of people who've fallen into the jobs. We're there because we like a kind of certain lifestyle. We want to be journalists, but we don't want to work the scary news beats. So we're not trained in investigative journalism, and therefore it's not our nous to go around seeking out these things that are wrong. So, and also the other problem is, as well as on a newspaper, a fashion desk is there to provide some colour. So in the news pages, you've got war, you've got politics. The news editor wants to have a pretty frock worn by a pretty woman to illustrate it. That's the most news desks are ruled by men, and that's how it goes. So it means that the major issues that go around fashion are usually go largely forgotten. The other problem as well is that it's difficult for news pages to actually cover these issues without a fashion journalist there, because you have to actually understand fashion to be able to write about it properly. If someone writes a fashion story without any knowledge of fashion, quite often they get the facts wrong, and so it means that the companies that they're trying to attack or show up, it becomes null and void because of these mistakes, these basic mistakes in copy. Understanding fashion to write about it, this kind of vaguely hints at the collusion that is also true of much fashion journalism. Many of the people who call themselves fashion journalists also actually work in the industry themselves. They style shows like Will show and they help out at labels and they're kind of part of the industry as well. They're not just on writing objectively. We get discount cards, we get sent free gifts, and what we each have to do is set our own standards if we're actually aware that there should be standards on these issues. My personal standards are that I accept gifts, but I don't ever seek them out, and I never accept gifts as a bribe. In other words, if you send me a bag, it doesn't mean I'm going to write about it. That does tend to mean I get less gifts than most. But whatever our personal standards, these are links that in other industries would really get questioned as a conflict of interest. It also shows that there are not just ethical issues that fashion journalists should be covering, but there are ethical issues about fashion journalism itself. The big problem is, though, is that there is another point of collusion. We're consumers, fashion journalists. We love shopping, that's why we do it. But we're consumers like everyone else. And, we all buy from high street brands. We all want the cheaper, we all want the quicker. That's what we do if we're honest. I wrote an article in The Guardian about a year or so ago where my starting point was looking at all the labels on my clothes and their country of origin. And I had absolutely no idea about the ethical origin of any of my clothes. I don't know about anything I'm wearing today either. But the big problem is for all of us is there is as yet, well, I think this is still correct, there is as yet no fair trade mark for fashion, because there are so many levels of production that need to be ratified from the actual cotton pickers or the actual raw materials for the fabric to the producers, to the production lines. There is no clear-cut way, like with food, where you can just say that farmer is doing certain practices, therefore it's fair trade. What this means is there's a fudge of the issue. However much you want fashion to become a more ethical industry, the lack of an obvious direction for the mass market, I'm not talking about brands who set themselves up to be an ethical brand, there is a lack of obvious direction in which to achieve big business in an ethical way. And basically that allows business to pretty much excuse itself and carry on as it did before. What also happens, and actually I'm going to talk about Gap as well, what happens is that the big companies that in the 90s had their image damaged by books like Naomi Klein's No Logo, they're now savvy to this whole situation. And this report from Gap was a direct result of realizing that their perception within the younger generations was being tarnished by any mention of Gap in those books. So Gap set up this department, and actually two representatives from San Francisco from this department came to see me after I wrote this article to try and convince me of of the work they were doing. And they were very convincing, but it did still seem to be that it was a bare minimum, that they were doing as much as they could to keep the critics away. But they're making money. We want to go and buy cheap clothes. And so therefore, they're going to keep making money by us going and buying cheap clothes. To me, the basic problem in the whole thing is that historically, as shown by the nursery rhymes, the clothing industry is one based on exploitation. People have always been paid poorly and treated badly, and people have always made money from those poor conditions. That doesn't mean that what has gone on before should happen now, but it does mean that the faults in the infrastructure of the industry are very deep-seated. Now, I want to write about fashion, that's why I do it. If you want to write about fashion, you have to get involved with fashion, and you have to go along for the ride, or else I couldn't write about it. You can't write from the outside. It's just a question of making sure your own personal standards are not crossed, that you feel happy with what you're doing, and that you're able as much as possible to be objective. Now, obviously, at the moment, I work on a glossy magazine rather than a hard-nosed newspaper, so I have to keep watching this carefully, but hopefully I'll be able to keep objective and keep doing the job.
Thank you. I think Charlie demonstrates as well how difficult it is in the world of fashion to try and tread that balance between keeping your own moral standards and actually trying to work out what the standards are, in fact. Next line, we have Pablo Flack from House of Jazz. I'm going to try and get some images behind you. If it goes horribly wrong, they are available at www.vogue.com underneath House of Jazz, and also www.londonfashionweek.com as well. Okay, so please, the floor is yours.
Well, the last time I was in this room, I think Virginia Bottomley was getting eggs thrown at her, so it's quite strange to be in her shoes. But, I mean, I've listened, obviously, to what everyone said on the panel, and as a doer on the panel, I obviously make clothes, work with factories in various places. All around the world, we use factories in India, we use factories in China, we use factories in England, we use factories in France. And I really don't refute anything that's being kind of said about the working practices of factories in fashion, and I think especially on a high street level, the end of the day, the consumer is wanting to buy a particular look, probably copied from Marc Jacobs or Prada or Miu Miu or another big label, and they want that to look exactly like the original, to be made in a much cheaper fabric containing a lot more nylon, and to be on the shelves for under £20. And that's kind of what's driving a very unethical production regime in fashion. From the higher end of fashion, and I don't think it's by choice, it's by accident, we tend to work with a lot more people that have to have higher skills. So for instance, our factory in India is a factory that's been going for years and years and years, and it's all about embroidery and very specific techniques. And in order for them to be able to produce that, they need to have members of staff that have been there for years, that are trained properly, that are looked after and stay with the company. And it's not cheap for India, the production that we do. It's the other thing as well is we couldn't produce it in England. The skills don't exist anymore. So I'm not saying that fashion is ethical, but I'm just saying from my point of view, I'm quite aware of all the points that have been made. My major point is to try and explain to you why fashion is seen as unethical and why it is unethical. And the classic example is something like Naomi Campbell, who in the mid-90s did a campaign for anti-fur, and then went down a catwalk and wore fur, because that just sums up the majority of people in fashion. They are so one-dimensional and incredibly dumb. And I've thought about different ways of dressing this up, but that is the truth. And I don't think it's there necessarily being on purpose unethical. You've got to remember that in fashion, what matters when we're doing our catwalk show, I don't know if the image is there or not, but if we're doing a catwalk show, all we're caring about is a look. It doesn't matter where anything's come from or how it's arrived at that point. All we care about is putting 20, 30 girls down a catwalk in a look that's specific for that season. That's what drives fashion. Fashion is all about creating a look. The stylists, the designers create a look on the catwalk. The stylists then reinterpret that look in a magazine that, you know, makes it cool for the kind of the readers to buy into. Advertising reinforces that. Charlie touched on the point where a lot of people in fashion, it's there's absolutely no ethical policy in how people deal with advertising, journalism. There's no divide between the two. You've got a stylist probably works on a shooting the campaign, creating the style for, say, a big label like Marc Jacobs. They probably also work for a magazine, so they're going to use lots of Marc Jacobs in that magazine to make sure the advertising stays high. And that's fashion. It's not an ethical business. And I think the only way that ever you will make it ethical is that, which has happened with organic food in supermarkets, people are buying into organic food not because they really actually care about the pesticides or anything like that. They just care that what the other person at the till thinks when they put down their product, that it's a premium product. And that's what drives the majority of people. And I think we can all discuss it in a kind of very removed way and very intellectualized. But that's the fundamentals of it. People, you're dealing with marketing and people. We live in a capitalist society, a free market society, or what President Bush would probably call a democratic society. And fashion is the ultimate expression of that society, where the society becomes so frivolous that, you know, you get people that set themselves up to make clothes that aren't necessary and just create a look and put it down the catwalk. And, you know, I mean, how can we possibly sit and say that that is a justified or worthwhile, as Nick was saying when he was in his introduction, role for anyone? Having said all that, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's really good fun, and it's kind of like, you know, there's a really great side to it. There's a lot of really interesting people in fashion, and a lot of people in fashion aren't, I don't think, intentionally unethical. It drives back to this point that they really do want, they're caring about a look. And not all of you might understand that, but I kind of have two heads. I have my LSE head that's drilled in all these kind of social and ethical issues that I should think about, and my economic side, etc. And then I have the other side of me where I just switch all that off and I have fun and I, you know, care about the look. I think that we can make designers and high streets more ethical in their production, again, by making, like organic food, by making it some kind of trademark that's kind of cool to be there on the clothes. And that's just down to, let's get a marketing company in and market it to the people, because once they've bought into it, they'll buy into it in their droves. And that's, you know, it's not about the ethics, it's about the marketing, and that's what it will always be about. So maybe that's what we should do, and if not, that doesn't work, then just legislate. You know, it's kind of, you just, people aren't going to shift what they're doing or what the look's about just because they think that, you know, they should use cotton that isn't made in X, Y, or Z. It just goes back to, it's all about a look. And that's kind of all I can really say about it. So probably not saying what I should have said as a fashion person, but I don't really care, to be quite honest.
I think that's absolutely brilliant, and really a very candid and honest way of looking at things, but still the idealism is there as well, both in the way you operate and in what you do and how you design. Thank you very much. And what we'll do, I might get a bit of technical help, and we'll try and get onto the Vogue website and look at your things at the end, so we keep the severity of the backdrop at the moment the same. Now, I think Sumi is actually quite right. Your fighters, your thinkers, and your doers all mixed up. So, to another thinker, fighter, and doer, in her world, Elizabeth Rouse.
And I think Pablo stole some of my lines. I was certainly thinking about what ethical behaviour means, and looking at notions of maleficence and beneficence, and notions of, you know, not doing people harm and respecting rights on the one hand, and actually serving the interests of others. And I have to say that the fashion industry doesn't do very well in all this, be it sweatshops in the third world, or indeed the way they treat students on work placement. We were chatting in... before we came on stage about the way that some designers treat our students. I think also, just taking up a point of Pablo's about fur, I think I'm saddened to see that the ethical issue that takes up most column inches in the Western press is fur. I suppose typical British concern with animals over people. And I suppose what I'm interested in looking at is to some extent the relationship that emerges from the fashion system between what we might define as consuming societies and producing societies, or at least specific social groups within those societies. Simi's referred to the fact that these relationships are characterised by voracious appetites for rapidly changing styles, the desire by middle-aged Americans, and indeed no doubt European professional women, for something new every time they go into their particular favourite store. When they browse, they want to see something new as they get bored. And in the UK, I suppose I'm surprised constantly by the determination of some British shoppers, unlike the organic group, who I am a member of, to actually pay as little as possible for goods like clothes and food. It seems to be a matter of pride for some British people to pay as little as they can, and how this kind of sits so uneasily with the notion of fair trade. Now, so that voracious appetite is set against the effects of cotton production on health that have been mentioned, working conditions and derisory levels of pay, where there's a great disjuncture between the clean-cut brand image, the consumed, and the reality of production. However, be it sweatshops or really the supply chain that fuels many mass-produced goods, it is to do with driving down costs, as Sumi said, maximising profits, and minimising price for relatively affluent consumers. And as a fashion educator, I'm certainly implicated in this process, in that, at least in part, fashion education is about enabling students to exploit the market, appealing to consumers, even if ethics and sustainable design are becoming very common components in curriculum. And I think I just wanted to say, really, that these issues aren't particular to fashion or clothing. I mean, we can find it in car production, we can find it in other consumer goods. Many consumer goods that are exchanged in the global marketplace have elements of unethical production. But it's fashion we're concerned with, and I think there's something special about fashion and clothing, which makes it an interesting case. There are issues about the mode of production, the use of hand sewing and embroidery, as Pablo's referred to, the domestic scale production that makes it particularly susceptible to unmonitored labour. However, what I want to turn our attention to is two other aspects of fashion and fashion as a consumer good. One is the impact that fashion culture has on these societies who are perhaps predominantly now producers of fashion, but increasingly becoming consumers of fashion. And to link that to the close relationship between self and identity and the body, the notions of dominant aesthetics and the implications within a global market. So my argument is fashion is different from other consumer goods. And Nick's alluded to this. You get dressed. Dress is a practice that all of us engage in, one which is situated within particular cultural and social milieu. Dress and fashion are discursive practices, representational. So choosing clothes, putting them on, how they make you feel, is about entering into discourses of style and various looks. It's about communication and social situation. The body and dress are also caught up in relations of power. Gender is probably the most frequently examined in fashion literature. The debates about dress and notions of freedom and democracy and choice in relation to Islamic women at the moment, I think, is a wonderful example of how it's a difficult one for us to deal with. Is it repressive or is it liberating to not be involved in fashion? But also there's the hierarchy, and there is a hierarchy of fashionableness of style, modern versus traditional, Western versus indigenous. But dress is an embodied experience, and the use of dress is a means by which individuals orient themselves in the social world and indeed a global context. Nick's already mentioned that dress has been one of the ways in which groups have asserted cultural identity, ethnic, religious, gender. It's been used to show subservience, the status of the dominated, as well as to express resistance. And I think when we're looking at our relationships with third world countries and countries outside the American European dimension, colonizing powers have sought to civilize through the introduction of Western or Christian dress, clothing naked savages. On the other hand, going native or alliance with the ruling power is also expressed through dress. One of the things I want to explore is this emerging homogeneity, a growing dominance of certain looks. And I think the arguments about the homogeneity of global culture are well rehearsed, as are the challenges offered by diversity and variety of localised and popular discourses. But dress still remains an example par excellence of a growing homogeneity, the emergence of a global culture, as Western styles of dress dominate and brands have worldwide appeal. And on the other hand, it provides examples of styles which have set themselves against such cultures in the world, based on tradition and subcultural styles. But rather like species of wildlife, I think indigenous and traditional forms of dress are disappearing. Things like the embroidery skills of Indians are at risk. Or they're revived, rather like the Japanese kimono for special occasions, rather like rare animals in zoos. So things are being lost. A number of commentators argue that it's its quest to conquer the global markets. In its quest, the fashion industry producing homogeneity of style, a global taste. And the power of brands, signifiers of social status and lifestyle, is that they work globally. Luxury brands, Prada, Miu Miu, etc., popular The Gap, are found in exclusive shopping areas or downtown shopping malls, in metropolitan centres all over the world. They speak to a global population of consumers. In a way, fashion cultures shouldn't be understood simply as a sort of form of westernisation, because they are a third culture. They are a metropolitan global culture, which go far beyond national boundaries and indeed continents. So these days, dominant forms of dress and the growing domination of particular types of aesthetic are achieved not through colonial powers or edicts, or, argue not laws, as Pablo might suggest, but through what Apadurai calls mediascapes and ideascapes, the flow of images and information across the world. The flow of images which are produced by newspapers, magazines, television and film, and of course increasingly the internet, and the flow of ideas, ideas about politics, ideas about consumption. In these images, a set of aesthetics in terms of clothes of the body are promoted. And I say set because obviously the aesthetic for youth is different to that for the 30-year-old professional. The fragmentation of aesthetics, or looks, to use Pablo's terms, within society goes along with the segmentation of the market. We don't have a global style, but a series of subsets creating distinctions, but obviously distinctions which are interdependent. I was in Delhi recently after 5 years, and what struck me was the perceptible change, not only in the clothes that were being shown, which showed a move towards overtly Western tastes, referencing Anglo-American street style, but most noticeable was the models on the catwalk, whose bodies showed all the evidence of the technologies of the self, as expressed by Mauss and Foucault, the moulding through diet and exercise to produce a form of body which closely resembles the fashion models that appear on European and American catwalks and in the media. And I think it's this aspect that I'm particularly interested in exploring, is that the domination not only of looks in clothes, but also looks in bodies. Now, early feminist critiques of fashion stress it as an oppressive and disempowering. And those kind of critiques have gone out of fashion themselves. More recent writers have celebrated the ability of fashion to challenge existing aesthetics, to be a means of resisting dominant views, and primarily to bring pleasure through active consumption. However, I'd suggest that there are a number of issues which remain. Students of fashion, both within the UK, and when I've met them in locations like Sri Lanka or in Hong Kong and China, important locuses of production, they want to break out of what they see as the cultural straitjacket of fashion looks as created in the West, to work within the discourses of their own culture, to find another language of looks than that of the dominant trends as disseminated through the media and vehicles like WGSN. Yet what the fashion companies in those countries want are, and what they're seeking, are young designers who can sell goods to global rather than local markets, who can appeal to the global consumer. And little of the literature on understanding fashion addresses the cultural consequences of the increasing dominance, not only of Western dress, but of particular aesthetics. And I thought I'd just sort of refer to two case studies of societies which have been opened up to fashion and consumer culture. Last week in the paper, there were a number of articles looking back on 10 years since apartheid. And there was a celebratory article, really, a report that's been produced on a group that are called Born Frees, those born after apartheid. And Born Frees are black and white, are techno-literate, plugged into world trends, they're materialist, they're hooked on brands. Born Frees appear to be the most brand-crazy generation ever. And by the age of 12, brands and labels are what township kids talk about. They are the means of acceptance by peers and a route to self-confidence. These young people are not interested in politics. They don't care about the struggle that resulted in Mandela's release from prison. However, I suppose a very positive outcome is that they share a common consumer culture. It unites black and white. For example, the brand FUBU, created by black New Yorkers and worn by Afro-American community in the US, is equally popular with blacks and whites in South Africa. So on the one hand, consumer culture seems to offer a way forward, a way of forging new identities and possibilities. On the one hand, perhaps a distraction from more serious matters, what one might say. But at the same time as this burgeoning of consumer culture, in The Guardian, another article pointed to a growing problem in South Africa, that of anorexia. Until 10 years ago, it's alleged, there were no reported cases amongst black women of anorexia. Perversely, as opportunities for gaining an education and pursuing careers have increased, so too have the pressures to have what's seen as a European body. The ideal of the ample body is being replaced. You see models on the television, you want to be like them, and it hurts, said one teenager, who's reported to have asked her mother to take her to hospital to have the fat cut off her body. A psychiatrist commenting on the inverse relationship between empowerment and self-acceptance said someone who can be whoever they want to be, and yet they choose to squeeze themselves into the stereotypes of eating, shape, and size. In China, another country where there's been a surge of interest in fashion and beauty, where the rising middle classes are shaking off a dowdy Maoist cultural legacy, are using the reward of explosive economic growth to explore cosmetic possibilities, enjoying the freedom of choice that fashion allegedly offers. Shops and magazines in the city show endless images of long-legged Western models, and height is now frequently listed in job applications. Air stewardesses have to be over 5'5". I'm not tall enough to be an air stewardess in China. Now, more and more Chinese are undergoing leg lengthening operations, sometimes more than once. Legs are sawn through and cased in a metal framework which is used to extend the leg, and it's been compared to a medieval instrument of torture. Now, I actually want to avoid too much sensationalism, and obviously I chose not to bring pictures, because actually, you know, it's easy to say out there these people are doing things, but we know that this concern with literally carving the fashion body out of flesh is something that is alive and well in the UK and the US. In June 2000, I was invited to participate in a body image summit organised by the Labour government's Women's Unit, and representatives from organisations which have supported women with conditions such as anorexia were invited, but primarily the great and the good from the fashion retail business and from the fashion press were invited to respond to a project undertaken by 17-year-old London girls. The girls had been funded by the government to produce a report on how images in magazines and the clothes available to them affected them. And what they said was that they offered little diversity in terms of size, shape and colour. They argued that the mismatch between the fashion image and the realities of their own bodies and lives resulted in them having a poor self-image and low self-esteem. It was clear that there were some in the room who cared passionately about young women and their need to be valued, but from the fashion journalist, with a few notable exceptions such as Karen Franklin, there was the usual sort of stuff about needing to sell a look and needing to present aspirational images to sell ideas and clothes. So I suppose what I want to ask in relation to the ethics of fashion is, how can we, is it possible to develop aesthetics which genuinely offer diversity, not lip service, but which allow a range of aesthetics which are not based on segmentation of the market? And is there a time when the media will accept responsibility for some of the consequences, intended or not, of the images that circulate in the global economy?
Thank you very much. That was an incredibly hard-hitting and I think very thought-provoking talk. And I think it's very interesting that the London College of Fashion is not just about fluffy design at all. It is very much exploring all the hard areas of fashion and really goes into the areas of sociology, anthropology, and economics we talked about earlier. Finally, we come to Pascal Morand, a noted economist and director of the French Institute of Fashion, who will bring the discussion to a close. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Like Elizabeth, I will start with some remarks about the notion of ethics of fashion and ethics by itself, because I think that what is very interesting and stimulating, but at the same time difficult, is that ethics, before arriving at the ethics of fashion specifically, ethics is a difficult and complex and ambiguous question. Sometimes I'm surprised by the fact, what I'm going to say is not nihilism. I'm very much convinced by the importance of ethics and by the fact that it is the new political challenge for the century. But this, at the same time, when I listen sometimes to people talking about ethics as something obvious and objective and very easy to define, I find that sort of funny in a way, because we have to keep in mind that ethics is in the heart, maybe not the heart, but almost the heart of the moral philosophy. That many philosophers wrote thousands and thousands of pages about that topics. But this has conceptual but also operational consequences. It's not always easy to distinguish the border between the good and the bad, and that's one of the key problems. I like a line by Spinoza saying, "We don't desire things because they are good, but we declare them good because we desire them." This kind of analysis, you find them with many, many people. I'm not going to quote or to mention now, but you see what I mean anyhow. The problem is that once we have said that, how can we deduct what the definition and the way of measuring ethics or ethical practices according to a certain vision of what they should be, of what ethics should be. Often people distinguish three fields for ethics, three pillars: the economic, the social, and the environmental pillar. But once again, the difficulty is that it's not clear the way you measure them. You can have good practices, you can have some elementary rules, but then going further than that requires, hard work and maybe a certain time, a minimum time to be precise. I take the example of the social pillar, let's say. If you read the books that are devoted to that, to the in the framework of the labor world organization, it's something extremely complex. You try to find summaries, but you don't find them. You have interesting footnotes, but then you don't find exactly what you would like to find. At the same time, there are good experiences and fruitful of decent work, doing decent work, practices, and setting up of practices in different countries, but that remains difficult. if we take the case, the pillar, the environmental pillar, we probably can say that some basic rules should be defined in terms of concerning, let's say, water or the air, like having elementary, at least elementary filtering system for water in factories, in every country. And that would be probably the best approach. Same thing for the humans, for the social aspect and the human rights. Another consequence is that because it's an ambiguous notion, it gives birth to many debates. We have also to keep in mind that ethics and the moral aspects are not taken into account, like the social aspects are not in the same way in the World Trade Organization framework. And more than that, when the developed countries want to introduce that and want to introduce ethical rules, some of the developing countries are reluctant. Maybe because they fear, in a way, some kind of a Machiavellian strategies, but also because they fear that this will be something which will look like, in fact, a protectionist, coming back to protectionism. We could go further and give other examples, many examples. Why? Because talking about ethics touches the notion, the systems of values of economics and societies around the world. So that is what I wanted to say as an introduction about ethics. Now, if we go back, if we get more precisely to the ethics of fashion. First, I can say a few words about fashion in terms of the visible part of the iceberg. An interesting point with fashion is that it sort of crystallizes the contradictions of ethics within the globalization framework. In a way, on one side, fashion is extremely superficial. Elizabeth mentioned the fact that it favors, that the images of brands and of fashion objectively favors anorexia and other pathological syndromes, which is in fact a scandal. But there are also other aspects. A war in a tragedy. Sometimes in the fashion world, it becomes something like a fashion trend. When Amit Karzai was nominated elected as the president of Afghanistan, I mean, some fashion people were very much interested somehow by the fact that he could save Afghanistan, but also by the fact that he was very chic and trendy. So we have many examples like that in mind. At the same time, we know also that fashion and fashion brands are sold all over, well, not sold, but shown at least all over the planet, and that many people look at fashion advertising, but just will never have the possibility to afford buying that type of products. And this, of course, favors, encourages frustration and bitterness. And of course, there are some like counter trends, but which might not be enough. Many people think it's good that, for instance, you can buy this brand Misericordia, and that buying that, you help developing an orphan's home in Peru, paying at a certain price. I think it's good, but I just think that it is not enough to buy. It is a too cheap a price to buy sort of a good consciousness. So we things have to be more global. So that's one thing. But on the contrary, I think that fashion is very serious. In fact, it is as serious as this, as the superficial. It's very serious, and it can be, and it is, very political. Think of what's happening in non-democratic countries or in many developing countries. The development of fashion is seen as the development that's going along with the development of freedom. It involved the status of the woman, of the culture, of the design, of the notion itself of self-accomplishment. In many countries, it is seen like that. And even if you take, we were talking about fashion, you were talking about fashion magazines. In these countries, I'm talking in particular of Mediterranean countries, but we could take many, many other examples. The people who launch and who manage and who write in these journals see that their work, their jobs, as a political one. So that's one important visage to me of fashion. And more globally now, we know that fashion is intimately linked to democracy. And I think that, I strongly believe that democracy need to be frivolous, because if they are not, then they start, the country, the society start being gray, sad, and to look sad to many people, and the direction might be not good. So I think it is absolutely linked. And I also think that fashion is deeply linked to the urban culture, to the urban zeitgeist, and that, in fact, it is superficial. It can be superficial when people involved in fashion are themselves superficial, in the same way as engineers or politicians can be extremely superficial. But in fact, it's much more global. Well, I'm not going to get back. I wanted to say a few words about fashion and streetwear and everything, but it was already said, so I'm not going to develop that. One last thing, which is rarely, not often mentioned in Europe, that struck me, but it goes along with the relative notion of fashion, is the kind of debate about the ethics of fashion that we do have in countries like Japan. The question to know is if fashion is ethical or not is often linked in Japan to the fact that that fashion is something ephemeral, that you have a strong renewal of products, and that is not good for the use of resources on the earth. Concerning now the production process, several people in the panel talked about that. So I just want to say a few remarks, a limited number of remarks. My first remark about that is that, of course, we do benefit from the fact that brands fear very much the setting up of a rumor saying that they exploited people and they were not ethical. We know that, and that's a good point, and it enables a sort of carrot and stick approach, which is good for the development of ethical practices. The second thing is that there is a sort of contradictory notion about that, contradictory trend that Elizabeth mentioned. And this contradictory trend is, of course, linked to the lowering of prices. And if prices go down, and even if retailers say, we are the best ethical people, they put a terrible pressure on prices. But prices go down for many reasons and in interacting with each other. And of course, this implies that producers and subcontractors can sometimes have the idea of not paying the social security, lowering the level of their social commitment, in a way, reversed auction reverse auctions, which are developing a lot now within many retailers and many systems, are absolutely a non-ethical system. Maybe Oxfam should say we should stop and use its strong lobbying power to say that kind of things, but maybe they do that already. But I think that this can involve a dangerous process, because we can have firms having like Nike or others, or Gap, having a strong commitment, apparent commitment in ethics, a good department, several people working in, but at the same time, with the hidden part of the iceberg being not so nice. I have two more remarks. We have to take care, I think, and to be careful with what I can call the syndrome of the drunk guy. What I mean by that is, you know, this idea of the guy who is drunk and who has lost his keys, and he's under a street lamp, and he can't find his keys, and he's just turning around the lamp, and somebody comes and says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I've lost my keys." And he says, "Why are you looking for your keys just right here?" And he says, "Because this is the only place where I can see anything." But if you think of that, and if you apply that to the control of the production process and social conditions, I've seen sometimes, and also discussing with social agencies, that there is like a natural incentive to go to control what is easier to control, and whereas there are many things that nobody ever sees. The last point is ethical rules or habits, but let's say rules, are fundamental. But the question is to know who is defining them. What's happening now is that, of course, retailers and brands give more and more importance to that. And they also know, well, because of all what we said and each of us. But then the vicious circle is that because things are ambiguous, precisely what they tend to do is to define the criteria and to define their own criteria. And then it remains for them to check if they satisfied the criteria that they defined. So that's quite bad. So a very important point is the notion, how do we set up the body or the set of bodies which could give at least some elementary basic rules that everybody should have to apply, and without taking part in the setting up of them themselves, and which would make the world a little bit better already, and the fashion world. Thank you.
Well, we started off officially 5 minutes late, and in the sort of tradition of fashion shows, we are running late, but this is nothing. In Paris, 2 to 3 hours delay is by the norm. So we've got off lightly, but we really only have like 6 minutes, and I feel really, thank you so much for the IT support just hanging on in there. I'll make it up to you somehow. But we've got 6 minutes for some questions, if you have any. Right, 1, 2, 3, 4, first one.
That better? I'd like to ask you, given, obviously, the more people that promote ethical behaviour in the fashion industry, the better, but given the increasing number of ethical bodies and initiatives, such as the ETI, BITC, your forum, things like the UN Global Compact, do you think that it's going to lead to, basically, a situation where consumers and producers will be confused and won't really know which standards to apply and who can be trusted and can't be trusted because of the different affiliations that people will have?
That's an interesting question, and I'd like to answer it by saying, one of the reasons the Ethical Fashion Forum has come about is because people have got together and said, we don't know where to go. There's a real demand for clothes which are made in an ethical way, and people don't know where to find them. They're really not available, they're not visible on the high street. And organizations like the ETI, and I think you mentioned the Fair Trade Foundation.
Yes,
right, there aren't any which specifically target fashion. Now, the ETI has become known for working with large fashion companies. However, it really isn't a resource, particularly for small designers and smaller companies. The fee to get involved with the ETI is very high, and they're actually designed as an organization to monitor codes and to work towards a standard code. The Ethical Fashion Forum is really just taking from what's there already and linking people together. And in terms of promoting, the Ethical Fashion Forum is not interested in promoting itself, really. What it's interested in is promoting the concept of fair trade and ethical fashion. That means the individual labels. So that's in the same way that the fashion advertising or publicity would in the general arena. I hope that answers.
Right, then we moved along. Can we see next on that row? Okay, yeah.
First, just a comment, sort of response to Pascal's comments, in that I think it's very easy sometimes to say, because of the blurry boundaries between what's good and bad, can actually postpone any progress. And at some point, towards the beginning of your talk, you said, well, there obviously are some good examples of some factories in the world where things have got better. But you didn't sort of add the caveat of, well, that's my opinion, but obviously everyone else might have a different opinion, as if there is some consensus as those are good examples. And in which case, I think, by making too much of the point of who's defining good and who's defining bad, I think we have come quite a long way in doing that, and therefore it's sort of more a question of just getting on and transferring those good examples elsewhere. Mm. But the other thing was on certification. And Charlie mentioned sort of the difficulties perhaps in such a complicated industry with such a long supply chain of certification. But I was wondering whether Tamsin, in your organisation, that was something you'd been considering, a bit like the Forest Stewardship Council, maybe just starting with jeans or one particular item of clothing, because I think certifying the whole industry might be a bit difficult, but that was an idea.
Thanks very much. Do you like to just keep the questions going and then more or less got 3 minutes left? Yeah, you know yourself.
Hi, I have nothing to do with fashion apart from wearing clothes. And this was an interesting disclosure. So basically the crux of matter is that whatever we discussed over here regarding the production line of fashion, which happens to be in the underdeveloped countries, there are three important things which are coming out. One is the fashion houses, which we are targeting from an ethics perspective. Then there are the consumers in these developed countries. And then there are the producing countries. So as far as the consumers in these countries are concerned, example of your trademark example and stuff, I completely agree to the gentleman saying that these are nothing but marketing initiatives and would ultimately lead to nothing but a business out of ethics of fashion. The other thing regarding the fashion houses, I agree that all the efforts which are going on from a fashion houses perspective of trying to implement ethics into the production houses, they are correct, but look at the very reason why did they move to these countries. They moved to these countries because it was not possible to do ethical production here. That's why they moved over there. It's purely out of economic benefits. So let's say they are getting the work done out of India. If India is unable to comply with the ethical benefits and all that jazz, then they're going to move to some other country, which is going to provide them the same benefits and maybe provide the image which they want. Now the third thing, which is very important, what I want to ask is that are we creating the right voices at the right places? The governments in those countries, maybe the government in India or Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, which can actually do something with regard to the working conditions there, are we creating the voices there or are we just creating voices in LSE and London? I don't know. If that is, then that is wrong. It should not happen like that. Because I come from India and I came with the impression that we are going to talk about the type of clothes we wear and all that jazz, but we talk of production. And in India, nobody talks of that. Absolutely no one talks of that. No one talks of production and what are the malpractices going on over there. So are we creating the right voices at the right places? Second thing, just like if there is a chicken flu in Asian countries, people are forced to kill their chicken just because the quality is not good. And only a certain standard of quality of goods, maybe steel or cars, can come to developed countries. So why not have the same thing for fashion? Why target the industry to use trademarks? Target the government. Ask your governments to stop all imports from countries which are not giving ethical treatment to their producers. So just create the right voices in the right places, if it is possible. Thank you.
Well, okay, this must be the final question. I'm really sorry, but
okay, well, this is a question mainly for Pablo, but maybe Charlie has something to say about it as well.
I think someone said about jazz that if you don't get it, you never will. But I'd be really interested to hear a bit more about what you mean by a look and what you see it as involving, because it obviously has quite a lot to do with beauty, but maybe also with some nebulous cool and sex and economics and some zeitgeist, perhaps. But I'd be really interested to hear what you had to say about that.
Well, a look can be any of those things, and I think it depends on the individual designer what, you know, their look is going to be. And some people are influenced by a myriad of different things, and I'd imagine quite a lot of it for people like Versace and Dolce & Gabbana is sex, is probably high up there. For us, it tends to be quite novelty and kind of, you know, we watch a particular film and that's what we become influenced by, or you know, a particular kind of exhibition that's on, or just like what you see on the street, that's what influences your look. And I can't, you know, particularly say there's a formula to what's going to, you know, make the look for that season. It's just a kind of quite a passionate thing, I think. I think that some people have probably quite ethical looks, and some people do it quite, you know, in quite a deep and sometimes quite political way. Hazel, my business partner in House of Jazz, was teaching at the LCF, and someone was, their whole collection was derived from the Holocaust and their family's experience. What I think happens in fashion is that those kinds of influences get flushed out as it goes down the chain, and as it becomes more commercial and more into the mainstream or into the glossy magazines, and it essentially boils down to sex, I'd say.
Oh, well, we're going to have to leave it with that word. I think it's funny that the designer should have the last word as well. Thank you very much to all the panel. Thank you.